the smiley face shirt, the thick pubic hair pressed against his leg. It had been less than a day, but it felt like long ago. His mind felt unstable, like an unbalanced set of scales. The core of his memories wouldn't settle down in one spot. Suddenly anxious, Tengo looked around him. Was this reality actually real, or had he once again boarded the wrong reality? He asked a passenger nearby and made sure this train was indeed headed to Tateyama. "It's okay. Don't worry," he told himself. "At Tateyama I can change to the express train to Tokyo." He was drawing farther and farther away from the cat town by the sea. As soon as he changed trains and took his seat, as if it could barely wait, sleep claimed him. A deep sleep, like he had lost his footing and fallen into a bottomless hole. His eyelids closed, and in the next instant his consciousness had vanished. When he opened his eyes again, the train had passed Makuhari. The train wasn't particularly hot inside, yet he was sweating under his arms and down his back. His mouth had an awful smell, like the stagnant air he had breathed in his father's sick room. He took a stick of gum out of his pocket and popped it in his mouth. Tengo was sure he would never visit that town again, at least not while his father was alive. While there was nothing in this world that he could state with 100% certainty, he knew there was probably nothing more he could do in that seaside town. When he got back to the apartment, Fukaeri wasn't there. He knocked on the door 3 times, paused, then knocked 2 more times. Then he unlocked the door. Inside, the apartment was dead silent. He was immediately struck by how neat and clean everything was. The dishes were neatly stacked away in the cupboard. Everything on the table and desk was neatly arranged, and the trash can had been emptied. There were signs that the place had been vacuumed as well. The bed was made, and no books or records lay scattered about. Dried laundry lay neatly folded on top of the bed. The oversized shoulder bag that Fukaeri used was also gone. It didn't appear, however, that she had remembered something she had to do, or that something had suddenly come up and she had hurriedly left. Nor did it look like she had just gone out for a short time. Instead, all indications were that she had decided to leave for good, that she had taken her time cleaning the apartment and then left. Tengo tried picturing her pushing around the vacuum cleaner and wiping here and there with a wet cloth. It just didn't fit her image at all. He opened the mail slot inside the front door and found the spare key. From the amount of mail, she must have left yesterday or the day before. The last time he had called her had been in the morning, 2 days earlier, and she had still been in the apartment. Last night he had had dinner with the 3 nurses and had gone back to Kumi's place. What with one thing and another, he had forgotten to call her. Normally she would have left a note behind in her unique cuneiform-like script, but there was no sign of one. She had left without a word. Tengo wasn't particularly surprised or disappointed. No one could predict what the girl was thinking or what she would do. She just showed up when she wanted to and left when she felt like it, like a capricious, independent-minded cat. In fact, it was unusual for her to have stayed put this long in one place. The refrigerator was more full of food than he had expected. He guessed that a few days earlier, Fukaeri must have gone out and done some shopping on her own. There was a pile of steamed cauliflower as well, which seemed to have been cooked recently. Had she known that Tengo would be back in Tokyo in a day or two? Tengo was hungry, so he fried some eggs and ate them with the cauliflower. He made some toast and drank 2 mugs of coffee. Next, he phoned his friend who had covered for him at school and told him he expected to be back at work at the beginning of the week. His friend updated him on how much they had covered in the textbook. "You really helped me out. I owe you one." "I don't mind teaching," the friend said. "I even enjoy it at times. But I found that the longer you teach, the more you feel like a total stranger to yourself." Tengo had often had an inkling of the same thing. "Anything out of the ordinary happen while I was gone?" "Not really. Oh, you did get a letter. I put it in a drawer in your desk." "A letter?" Tengo asked. "From whom?" "A thin young girl brought it by. She had straight hair down to her shoulders. She came up to me and said she had a letter to give you." She spoke sort of strangely. I think she might have been a foreigner.
Did she have a large shoulder bag?
She did. A green shoulder bag, stuffed full of things.
Fuka'eri may have been afraid to leave the letter behind in his apartment, scared that someone else might read it or take it away. So she went directly to the cram school and gave it to his friend.
Tengo thanked his friend again and hung up. It was already evening, and he didn't feel like taking the train all the way to Yoyogi to pick up the letter. He would leave it for tomorrow. Right afterward, he realized he had forgotten to ask his friend about the moon. He started to dial again, but decided against it. Most likely his friend had forgotten all about it. This was something he would have to resolve on his own.
Tengo went out and aimlessly sauntered down the twilight streets. With Fuka'eri gone, his apartment was too quiet, and he couldn't settle down. When they had been living together, he didn't really sense her presence all that much. He followed his daily routine, and she followed hers. But without her there, Tengo noticed a human-shaped void she had left behind. It wasn't because he was attracted to her. She was a beautiful, attractive young girl, for sure. But since Tengo first met her, he had never felt anything like desire for her. Even after sharing the same apartment for so long, he never felt anything stirring within his heart. How come? Is there some reason I shouldn't feel sexual desire for her? He wondered. It was true that on that stormy night they had had intercourse, but it wasn't what he had wanted. It had all been her doing. Intercourse was exactly the right word to describe the act. She had climbed on top of Tengo, who had been numb and unable to move, and inserted his penis inside her. Fuka'eri had seemed to be in some transcendent state then, like a fairy in the throes of a lewd dream. Afterward, they lived together in the tiny apartment as if nothing had happened. The storm had stopped, morning came, and Fuka'eri acted like she had completely forgotten the incident, and Tengo didn't bring it up. He felt that if she really had forgotten, it was better to let her stay that way. It might be best if he himself forgot it, too. Still, the question remained. Why had she suddenly done such a thing? Was there some objective behind it all? Or had she been temporarily possessed? There was only one thing Tengo knew for sure. It wasn't an act of love. Fuka'eri had a natural affinity for Tengo, that seemed certain. But it was far-fetched to believe that she loved him, or desired him, or felt anything even close to these emotions. She felt no sexual desire for anyone. Tengo wasn't confident in his powers of observation when it came to people, but still he couldn't quite imagine Fuka'eri passionately making love with a man, her breath hot and heavy, or even engaged in not-so-passionate sex. That just wasn't her. These thoughts ran through his head as he walked through the streets of Koenji. The sun had set and a cold wind had picked up, but he didn't mind. He liked to think while he walked, then sit down at his desk and give form to his thoughts. That was his way of doing things. That was why he walked a lot. It might rain, it might be windy, he didn't care. As he walked, he found himself in front of a bar called Mugiatama, Ears of Wheat. Tengo couldn't think of anything better to do, so he popped inside and ordered a Carlsberg draft beer. The bar had just opened, and he was the only customer. He stopped thinking for a while, kept his mind a blank, and slowly sipped his beer. But just like nature abhors a vacuum, Tengo wasn't afforded the leisure of keeping his mind blank for long. He couldn't help thinking of Fuka'eri. Like a scrap of a dream, she wended her way into his mind. That person may be very close, somewhere you can walk to from here. Fuka'eri had said this, which is why I went out to look for her, and came inside this bar. What other things did she say? Do not worry. Even if you cannot find that person will find you. Just as Tengo was searching for Aomame, Aomame was searching for him. Tengo hadn't really grasped that. He had been caught up in himself searching for her. It had never occurred to him that Aomame might be looking for him, too. I perceive, and you receive. This was also something Fukaeri had said. She perceives it, and Tengo receives it. But Fukaeri only made clear what she perceived when she felt like it. Whether she was operating on some principle or theory, or merely acting on a whim, Tengo couldn't tell. Again, Tengo remembered the time they had intercourse. The beautiful 17-year-old climbed on top of him and put his penis inside her. Her ample breasts moved lithely in the air, like ripe fruit. She closed her eyes in rapture, her nostrils flaring with desire. Her lips formed something that didn't come together as actual words. He could see her white teeth, her pink tongue darting out from between them every now and then. Tengo had a vivid memory of that scene. His body may have been numb, but his mind was clear, and he had a rock-hard erection. But no matter how clearly he relived the scene in his head, Tengo didn't feel any stir of sexual excitement, and it didn't cross his mind to want to have sex with her again. He hadn't had sex for the nearly 3 months since that encounter. More than that, he hadn't even come once. For him, this was quite unusual. He was a healthy, 30-year-old single guy with a normal sex drive, the sort of desire that had to be taken care of one way or another. Still, when he was in Kumi Adachi's apartment, in bed with her, her pubic hair pressing against his leg, he had felt no desire at all. His penis had remained flaccid the whole time. Maybe it was the hashish. But that wasn't the reason, he decided. On that stormy night when he had had sex with Fukaeri, she had taken something important away from his heart, like moving furniture out of a room. He was convinced of it. Like what, for instance? Tengo shook his head. When he had polished off the beer, he ordered a 4 roses on the rocks and some mixed nuts, just like the last time. Most likely, his erection on that stormy night was too perfect. It was far harder and bigger than he had ever experienced. It didn't look like his own penis. Smooth and shiny, it seemed less an actual penis than some conceptual symbol, and when he ejaculated, it was powerful, heroic even, the semen copious and thick. This must have reached her womb, or even beyond. It was the perfect orgasm. But when something is so complete, there has to be a reaction. That's the way things go. What kind of erections have I had since? Tengo wondered. He couldn't recall. Maybe he hadn't even had one. Or if he had, it was obviously not very memorable. A subpar hard-on. If his erection had been a movie, it would have been low-budget, straight to video. Not an erection even worth discussing. Most likely. Maybe I'm fated to drift through life with nothing but second-rate erections, he asked himself. Or not even second-rate ones. That would be a sad sort of life, like a prolonged twilight. But depending on how you look at it, it might be unavoidable. At least once in his life he had had the perfect erection and the perfect orgasm. It was like the author of Gone with the Wind. Once you have achieved something so magnificent, you have to be content with it. He finished his whiskey, paid the bill, and continued wandering the streets. The wind had picked up, and the air was chillier than before. Before the world's rules loosen up too much, he thought, and all logic is lost, I have to find Aomame. Nearly the only hope he could cling to now was the thought that he might run across her. If I don't find her, then what value is there to my life? He wondered. She had been here in Koenji in September. If he were lucky, she was still in the same place. Not that he could prove it, but all he could do right now was pursue that possibility. Aomame is somewhere around here, and she is searching for me, too. Like two halves of a coin, each seeking the other. He looked up at the sky, but he couldn't see the moons. I have to go someplace where I can see the moon, Tengo decided.
Chapter 13. Ushikawa. Is this what they mean by back to square one? Ushikawa's appearance made him stand out. He did not have the sort of looks suited for stakeouts or tailing people. As much as he might try to lose himself in a crowd, he was as inconspicuous as a centipede in a cup of yogurt. His family wasn't like that at all. Ushikawa's family consisted of his parents, an older and younger brother, and a younger sister. His father ran a health clinic where his mother was the bookkeeper. Both brothers were outstanding students, attended medical school, and became doctors. His older brother worked in a hospital in Tokyo, while his younger brother was a research doctor at a university. When his father retired, his older brother was due to take over the family clinic in Urawa, a suburb of Tokyo. Both brothers were married and had one child. Ushikawa's sister had studied at college in the United States and was now back in Japan working as an interpreter. She was in her mid-30s but still single. All his siblings were slim and tall, with pleasantly oval features. In almost every respect, particularly in looks, Ushikawa was the exception in his family. He was short, with a large misshapen head and unkempt frizzy hair. His legs were stumpy and bent like cucumbers. His popping eyes always looked startled, and he had a thick layer of flesh around his neck. His eyebrows were bushy and large, and nearly came together in the middle. They looked like two hairy caterpillars reaching out to each other. In school, he had generally gotten excellent grades, but his performance in some subjects was erratic, and he was particularly hopeless at sports. In this affluent, self-satisfied, elite family, he was the foreign element, the sour, dissonant note that ruined the family harmony. In family photos, he looked like the odd man out, the insensitive outsider who had pushed his way into the group and had his picture taken with them. The other members of his family couldn't understand how someone who didn't resemble them in the least could be one of them. But there was no mistaking the fact that his mother had given birth to him, with all the attendant labor pains. Her recollection was how particularly painful that birth had been. No one had laid him at their doorstep in a basket. Eventually, someone recalled that there was a relative who also had an oversized, misshapen head, Ushikawa's grandfather's cousin. During the war, he had worked in a metal shop in Koto Ward in Tokyo, but he died in the massive air raid in the spring of 1945. His father had never met the man, though he had a photo of him in an old album. When the family saw the photo, they exclaimed, "It all makes sense now." Ushikawa and his uncle were such peas in a pod that you would think that Ushikawa was the man reincarnated. The genetic traits of this uncle had, for whatever reason, surfaced once more. The Ushikawa family of Urawa, Saitama Prefecture, would have been the perfect family, in both looks and academic and career achievements, if only Ushikawa hadn't existed. They would have been the kind of memorable, photogenic family that anyone would envy. But with Ushikawa in the mix, people tended to frown and shake their heads. People might begin to think that somewhere along the line a joker or two had tripped up the goddess of beauty. No, they definitely must think this, his parents decided, which is why they tried their hardest to keep him out of the public eye, or at least make sure he didn't stand out, though the attempt was always pointless. Being put in this situation, however, never made Ushikawa feel dissatisfied, sad, or lonely. He wasn't sociable to begin with, and usually preferred to stay in the shadows. He wasn't particularly fond of his brothers and sister. From Ushikawa's perspective, they were irretrievably shallow. To him, their minds were dull, their vision narrow and devoid of imagination, and all they cared about was what other people thought. More than anything, they were completely lacking in the sort of healthy skepticism needed to attain any degree of wisdom. Ushikawa's father was a moderately successful doctor of internal medicine in the countryside, but he was so utterly boring that talking with him gave you chest pains. Like the king whose touch turned everything to gold, every single word he uttered turned into insipid grains of sand. but as a man of few words, he was able, probably unintentionally, to conceal how boring and ignorant he really was. In contrast, his mother was a real talker, a hopeless snob. Money was everything to her, and she was self-centered and proud, loved anything gaudy and showy, and could always be counted on to badmouth other people in a shrill voice. Ushikawa's older brother had inherited his father's disposition. His younger brother had his mother's. His sister was very independent. She was irresponsible and had no consideration for others. As the baby of the family, she had been totally pampered and spoiled by her parents. All of which explained why, since he was a boy, Ushikawa had kept to himself. When he came home from school, he had shut himself in his room and gotten lost in books. He had no friends other than his dog, so he never had the chance to talk with someone about what he had learned or debate anyone. Still, he was convinced that he was a clear, eloquent, logical thinker, and he patiently honed these abilities all by himself. For instance, he would propose an idea for discussion and debate it, taking both sides. He would passionately argue in support of the proposition, then argue just as vigorously against it. He could identify equally with either of the two positions, and was completely and sincerely absorbed by whatever position he happened to be supporting at the moment. Before he had realized it, these exercises had given him the talent to be skeptical about his own self, and he had come to the recognition that most of what is generally considered the truth is entirely relative. Subject and object are not as distinct as most people think. If the boundary separating the two isn't clear-cut to begin with, it is not such a difficult task to intentionally shift back and forth from one to the other. In order to use logic and rhetoric more clearly and effectively, he filled his mind with whatever knowledge he could find, both what he thought would be useful and what he was pretty sure was the opposite. He chose things he agreed with and things that initially he opposed. It wasn't cultivation and learning in the usual sense that he was after, but more tangible information, something you could actually handle, something with a real shape and heft. That huge, misshapen head of his turned out to be the perfect container for these quantities of accumulated information. Thanks to all this, he was far more erudite than any of his contemporaries. If he felt like it, he knew he could shoot down anybody in an argument, not just his siblings or classmates, but his teachers and parents as well. But he didn't want to attract any kind of attention if he could avoid it, so he kept this ability hidden. Knowledge and ability were tools, not things to show off. Ushikawa began to think of himself as a nocturnal creature, concealed in a dark forest, waiting for prey to wander by. He waited patiently for an opportunity, and when it came, he would leap out and grab it. But until that point, he couldn't let his opponent know he was there. It was critical to keep a low profile and catch the other person off guard. Even as an elementary school pupil, he had thought this way. He never depended on others or readily revealed his emotions. Sometimes he imagined how his life would be if he had been born a little better looking. He didn't need to be handsome. There was no need to look that impressive. He just needed to be normal-looking, or enough so that people wouldn't turn and stare. "If only I had been born like that," he wondered. "What sort of life would I have led?" But this was a supposition that exceeded his powers of imagination. Ushikawa was too Ushikawa-like, and there was no room in his brain for such hypotheses. It was precisely because of his large, misshapen head, his bulging eyes, and his short, bandy legs that he was who he was, a skeptical young boy, full of intellectual curiosity, quiet, but eloquent. As the years passed, the ugly boy grew up into an ugly youth, and before he knew it, into an ugly, middle-aged man. At every stage of his life, people continued to turn and stare. Children would stare unabashedly at him. "When I become an ugly old man," Ushikawa sometimes thought. Then maybe I won't attract so much attention. But he wouldn't know for sure. Maybe he would end up the ugliest old man the world had ever seen. At any rate, he was not equipped with the skills needed to blend into the background. And to make matters worse, Tango knew what he looked like. If he was discovered hanging around outside Tango's building, the whole operation would come crashing down. In situations like this, Ushikawa normally hired someone from a PI agency. Ever since he was a lawyer, he had made use of these sorts of organizations, which mostly employed former policemen who were adept at digging up information, shadowing people, and conducting surveillance. But in this case, he didn't want to involve any outsiders. Things were too touchy, and a serious crime, murder, was involved. Besides, Ushikawa wasn't even sure what he might gain by putting Tango under surveillance. What Ushikawa wanted was to make clear the connection between Tango and Aomame, but he wasn't even sure what Aomame looked like. He had tried all sorts of methods, but had yet to come up with a decent photo. Even Bat hadn't been able to obtain one. Ushikawa had looked at her high school graduation album, but in the class photo her face was tiny and somehow unnatural-looking, like a mask. In the photo of her company's softball team, she had on a wide-brimmed cap, and her face was in shadow. So even if Aomame were to pass him on the street, he would have no way of knowing if it was really her. He knew she was nearly 5 feet 6 inches tall and had a trim body and good posture. Her eyes and cheekbones were distinctive, and she wore her hair down to her shoulders. But there were plenty of women in the world who fit that description. So it looked like Ushikawa would have to undertake the surveillance by himself. He would have to keep his eyes open, patiently waiting for something to happen, and when it did, instantly react. He couldn't ask someone else to handle such a delicate undertaking. Tango was living on the third floor of an old 3-story concrete apartment building. At the entrance was a row of mailboxes for all the residents. One of them, with a name tag on it, said Kawana. Some of the mailboxes were rusty, the paint peeling off. They all had locks, but most of the residents left them unlatched. The front door of the building was unlocked and anyone could go inside. The dark corridor inside had that special odor you find in older apartment buildings. It is a peculiar mix of smells, of unrepaired leaks, old sheets washed in cheap detergent, stale tempura oil, a dried-up poinsettia, cat urine from the weed-filled front yard. Live there long enough and you would probably get used to the smell, but no matter how used to it you got, the fact remained that this was not a heartwarming odor. Tango's apartment faced the main road. It wasn't all that noisy, but there was a fair amount of foot traffic. An elementary school was nearby, and at certain times of day there were large groups of children outside. Across from the building was a clump of small single-family homes, 2-story houses with no garden. Just down the road were a liquor store and a stationery store catering to elementary school children, and 2 blocks farther down was a small police substation. There was nowhere to hide, and if he were to stand by the road and look up at Tango's apartment, even if Tango didn't discover him, the neighbors would be sure to cast a suspicious eye his way. And since he was such an unusual-looking character, the locals' alert level would be ratcheted up a couple of levels. He might be mistaken for a pervert waiting for the kids to get out of school, and neighbors might call the police. In surveillance, the first requirement is finding a suitable place from which to watch, a place to track your target's movements and maintain a steady supply of water and food. The ideal situation would be to have a room from which Ushikawa could see Tango's apartment. He could set up a camera with a telephoto lens on a tripod and keep watch over movement in the apartment and who came in and out. Since he was alone on the assignment, 24-hour coverage was impossible. But Ushikawa figured he could cover it for 10 hours a day. Needless to say, however, finding a suitable place was going to be tricky. Even so, Ushikawa walked the neighborhood, searching. He wasn't the type to give up easily. Tenaciousness was, after all, his forte. But after pounding the pavement of every nook and cranny of the neighborhood, Ushikawa called it quits. Koenji was a densely populated residential area, flat with no tall buildings. The number of places from which Tengo's apartment was visible was very limited, and there was not a single one he thought he could use. Whenever Ushikawa had trouble coming up with an idea, he liked to take a long, lukewarm soak in the tub. So he went back home and drew a bath. As he lay in the acrylic bathtub, he listened to Sibelius's violin concerto on the radio. He didn't particularly want to listen to Sibelius, and Sibelius's concerto wasn't exactly the right music to listen to at the end of a long day as he soaked in the tub. Perhaps, he mused, Finnish people like to listen to Sibelius while in a sauna during their long nights. But in a tiny one-unit bathroom of a two-bedroom condo in Kohinata Bunkyo Ward, Sibelius's music was too emotional, too tense. Not that this bothered him. As long as there was some background music, he was fine. A concerto by Rameau would do just as well, nor would he have complained if it had been Schumann's Carnival. The radio station just happened to be broadcasting Sibelius's violin concerto. That was all there was to it. As usual, Ushikawa let half his mind go blank and thought with the other half. David Oistrakh's performance of Sibelius went through the blank half of his mind, like a gentle breeze wafting in through a wide-open entrance and out through a wide-open exit. Maybe it was not the most laudable way of appreciating music. If Sibelius knew his music was being treated this way, it was easy to imagine how those large eyebrows would frown, the folds of his thick neck coming together. But Sibelius had died long ago, and even Oistrakh had long since gone to his grave. So Ushikawa could do as he pleased and let the music filter from right to left, as the unblank half of his brain toyed with random thoughts. In times like these, Ushikawa didn't like to have a set objective. He let his thoughts run free, as if he were releasing dogs on a broad plain. He would tell them to go wherever they wanted and do whatever they liked, and then he would just let them go. He sank down in the bathwater up to his neck, closed his eyes, and half listening to the music, let his mind wander. The dogs frolicked around, rolled down slopes, gambled after each other tirelessly, chased pointlessly after squirrels, then came back, covered in mud and grass, and Ushikawa petted their heads and fastened their collars back on. The music came to an end. Sibelius's violin concerto was a roughly 30-minute piece, just the right length. The next piece, the announcer intoned, is Janacek's Sinfonietta. Ushikawa had a vague memory of hearing the name of the piece before, but he couldn't remember exactly. When he tried to recall, his vision turned strangely cloudy and indistinct, as if a cream-colored mist had settled over his eyeballs. He must have stayed too long in the bath, he decided. He gave up, switched off the radio, got out of the bathtub, wrapped a towel around his waist, and got a beer from the fridge. Ushikawa lived by himself. He used to have a wife and two small daughters. They had bought a house in the Churinkan district in Yamato, in Kanagawa Prefecture. It was a small house, but they had a garden and a dog. His wife was good-looking enough, and his daughters were even pretty. Neither daughter had inherited anything of Ushikawa's looks, which was a great relief. Then, like a sudden blackout on the stage between acts, he was alone. He found it hard to believe that there had ever been a time when he had a family and lived with them in a house in the suburbs. Sometimes he was even sure the whole thing must have been a misunderstanding, that he had unconsciously fabricated this past for himself. But it had actually happened. He had actually had a wife he shared a bed with, and two children who shared his bloodline. In his desk drawer he had a family photo of the four of them. They were all smiling happily. Even the dog seemed to be grinning. There was no likelihood that they would ever be a family again. His wife and daughters lived in Nagoya now. The girls had a new father. the kind of father with normal looks who wouldn't embarrass them when he showed up at parent-teacher conference day. The girls hadn't seen Ushikawa for nearly 4 years, but they didn't seem to regret this. They never even wrote to him. It didn't bother Ushikawa much either that he couldn't see his daughters. This didn't mean that his daughters weren't important to him. It was just that now his top priority was simply keeping himself secure. So for the time being, he had to switch off any unnecessary emotional circuits and focus on the tasks at hand. Plus, he knew this, that no matter how far away his daughters went from him, his blood still flowed inside them. His daughters might forget all about him, but that blood would not lose its way. Blood had a frighteningly long memory, and the sign of that large head would sometime, somewhere in the future, reappear, in an unexpected time and unexpected place. When it did, people would sigh and remember that Ushikawa had once existed. Ushikawa might be alive to witness this eruption, or perhaps not. It didn't really matter. He was satisfied just to know that it was possible. It wasn't like he was hoping for revenge. Rather, he felt content to know that he was, unavoidably, an inherent part of the world's structure. He sat down on his sofa, plopped his stubby legs up on the table, and as he sipped his beer, a thought suddenly came to him. "It might not work out," he thought. "But it was worth trying. It's so simple. Why hadn't it occurred to me?" he wondered, finding it odd. "Maybe the easiest things are the hardest to come up with. Like they say, people miss what's going on right under their noses." The next morning, Ushikawa went to Koenji again. He saw a real estate agency, went inside, and asked if there were any apartments available for rent in Tango's building. But this agency didn't handle that building. All rentals in the apartment building were handled by an agency in front of the station. "I sort of doubt there are any units available," the agent said. "The rent is reasonable, and it's a convenient location, so few people move out." "Well, I'll ask anyway, just to make sure," Ushikawa said. He stopped by the agency in front of the station. A young man, in his early 20s, was the one who dealt with him. The man had jet-black hair, hardened with gel to the consistency of a bird's nest. He wore a bright white shirt and a brand new tie. He probably hadn't been working there long. He still had marks from pimples on his cheeks. The man flinched a bit when he looked at Ushikawa, but soon recovered and gave him a pleasant, professional smile. "You're in luck, sir," the young man said. "The couple on the first floor had some family issues that arose, and they had to move out quickly, so one of the units has been vacant for a week. We finished cleaning it yesterday, but haven't advertised it yet. It's on the first floor, so it might be a bit noisy, and it doesn't get a lot of sun, but it's a wonderful location. There is one condition of the contract, however. In 5 or 6 years, the owner plans to completely rebuild the place, so when you receive notice of that renovation 6 months ahead of time, you'll need to move out with no complaints. Plus, there's no parking lot there." "Not a problem," Ushikawa replied. He didn't plan to stay there that long, and he didn't have a car. "Excellent. If you agree to those conditions, then you can move in tomorrow. I imagine you would like to see the apartment first."
"Yes, of course,"
Ushikawa replied. The young man took a key out of a desk drawer and passed it to him. "I'm very sorry, but I have an errand to run, so if you don't mind, could you check out the place by yourself? The apartment is empty, and all you need to do is drop off the key on your way back."
"That sounds fine," Ushikawa said. "But what if I'm some evil man who never gives the key back, or makes a copy and sneaks in later to ransack the place? What would you do then?"
The young man stared in surprise at Ushikawa for a time. "Yes, good point. I see. Just to be on the safe side, could you give me a card?" Ushikawa took out one of his New Japan Foundation for the Advancement of Scholarship and the Arts business cards and handed it to him. "Mr. Ushikawa," the young man frowned as he read the name. But then he looked relieved. "You don't look to me like someone who would
do something bad.
Much appreciated,
Ushikawa replied, and he smiled, a smile as meaningless as the title listed on his card. No one had ever told him this before. Maybe it meant his looks were too unusual for him to ever do anything bad. It would be too easy for anyone to describe him, and a simple matter to draw a police sketch. If a warrant were issued for his arrest, he wouldn't last 3 days. The apartment was nicer than he had imagined. Tango's third-floor apartment was 2 stories directly above, so it was impossible to observe his place. But the front entrance was visible from his window, so he could see when Tango entered and exited the building, and spot anyone visiting him. He could just camouflage a telephoto lens and take pictures of each person's face. In order to rent this apartment, he had to pay 2 months' security deposit, 1 month's rent up front, plus a fee equivalent to the second month's rent. The rent itself wasn't that high, and the security deposit would be returned when the lease was up, but still, this all came to a hefty sum. Having just paid Bat, his resources were severely depleted. But he knew he had to rent that apartment. There was no other choice. Ushikawa went back to the real estate agency, took out the cash he had already prepared in an envelope, and signed the lease. The lease was with the New Japan Foundation for the Advancement of Scholarship in the Arts. He told them he would mail them a certified copy of the foundation's registry letter. This didn't seem to faze the young real estate agent. Once the lease was signed, the agent again handed him the keys. Mr. Ushikawa, the apartment is ready for you to move in today. The electricity and water are on, but you will have to be present when they turn on the gas, so please contact Tokyo Gas yourself. What will you do about a phone?
I'll handle that myself,
Ushikawa said. It took a lot of time and effort to get a contract with the phone company, and a workman would have to come to the apartment to install it. It was easier to use a nearby payphone. Ushikawa went back to the apartment and drew up a list of items he would be needing. Thankfully, the previous resident had left the curtains up. They were old, flowery curtains, but as long as they were curtains, he felt lucky to have them. Curtains of some kind were indispensable to a stakeout. The list of necessary items wasn't all that long. The main things he would need were food and drinking water, a camera with a telephoto lens, and a tripod. The rest of his list included toilet paper, a heavy-duty sleeping bag, portable kerosene containers, a camping stove, a sharp knife, a can opener, garbage bags, basic toiletries, and an electric razor, several towels, a flashlight, and a transistor radio. The minimal amount of clothes, and a carton of cigarettes. That was about it. No need for a fridge, a table, or bedding. As long as he had a place to keep out of the weather, he considered himself lucky. Ushikawa returned to his own house and put a single reflex and a telephoto lens in a camera bag, as well as an ample amount of film. He then stuffed all the items on his list into a travel bag. He bought the additional things he still needed in the shopping district in front of Koenji Station. He set up his tripod next to the window, attached the latest Minolta automatic camera to it, screwed on the telephoto lens, aimed it at the level of the faces of anyone who came in or exited the building, and set the camera to manual. He made it so he could use a remote control to work the shutter and set the motor drive. He fashioned a cardboard cone to go around the lens so that light wouldn't reflect off the lens. From the outside, part of a paper tube was visible at one end of the slightly raised curtain, but no one would ever notice it. No one would ever imagine that someone was secretly photographing the entrance of such a nondescript apartment building. Ushikawa took a few test shots of people coming in and out of the building. Because of the motor drive, he was able to get 3 quick shots of each person. As a precaution, he wrapped a towel around the body of the camera to muffle any noise. As soon as he finished the first roll, he took it to the photo store next to the station. The clerk placed it in a machine that would automatically develop and print the photos. It handled great numbers of photos at high speed, so no one ever noticed or cared about the images printed on them. The photos came out fine, not very artistic, to be sure, but serviceable. The faces of the people entering and exiting the building were clear enough to distinguish one from another. On the way back from the photo shop, Uchikawa bought some mineral water and several cans of food, and he bought a carton of Seven Stars at a smoke shop. Holding his bags of purchases in front of him to hide his face, he returned to the apartment and sat down again in front of the camera. As he kept watch over the entrance, he drank some water, ate canned peaches, and smoked a couple of cigarettes. The electricity was on, but for some reason not the water. When he turned on the tap, there was a rumbling sound in the wall, but nothing came out. Something had to be holding them up from turning on the water. He thought about contacting the real estate agent again, but wanting to limit his trips in and out of the building, he decided to wait and see. No running water meant he couldn't use the toilet, so instead he peed into an old bucket the cleaning company had conveniently forgotten to take away. The impatient early winter twilight came quickly, and the room grew totally dark, but still he didn't turn on the lights. Uchikawa rather welcomed the darkness. The light came on at the entrance, and he continued to survey the faces that passed by under the yellowish light. As evening came, the foot traffic into and out of the building increased a bit, though the number of people was still not that great. It was, after all, a small apartment building. Tengo was not among them, and neither was anyone who could possibly be Aomame. Tengo was scheduled to teach at the cram school today. He would be coming back in the evening. He didn't usually stop off anywhere on the way home after work. He preferred to make his own dinner rather than eat out, and he liked to eat alone while reading. Uchikawa knew all this, but Tengo didn't come home. Perhaps he was meeting someone after work. A variety of people lived in the building, everyone from young, single working people to college students to couples with small children to elderly people living alone, people from all walks of life. But all of them entered the frame of the lens unaware they were under surveillance. Despite some differences in age and circumstances, every one of them looked worn out, tired of life. They appeared hopeless, abandoned by ambition, their emotions worn away, with only resignation and numbness filling the void left behind. As if they had just had a tooth pulled, their faces were dark, their steps heavy. But he may have been mistaken. Some of them may have actually been enjoying life to the fullest. Once they opened their doors, there was some breathtaking little paradise waiting just for them. Perhaps some of them were pretending to live a Spartan life to avoid getting audited by the tax bureau. This was possible. But through the telephoto lens, they all looked like dead-end city dwellers not going anywhere in life, clinging to a cheap apartment scheduled to be torn down. That night, Tango didn't make an appearance, and Uchikawa saw no one who could be connected to him. When 10:30 rolled around, he decided to call it a day. He hadn't quite settled into a routine and didn't want to push it. "There will be many days to come," he decided. "So this is enough for now." He did a variety of stretches to loosen his stiff muscles, then ate a sweet anpan bun, poured coffee from his thermos into the cap, and drank it. He tried the faucet in the sink, and now the water was running. He washed his face with soap, brushed his teeth, and took a good long pee. He leaned back against the wall and smoked a cigarette. He longed for a sip of whiskey, but he had decided that as long as he was here, he wouldn't touch a drop of alcohol. He stripped to his underwear and snuggled into the sleeping bag. The cold made him tremble slightly. At night, the empty apartment was unexpectedly chilly. He thought he might need a small electric space heater. As he lay shivering, alone in the sleeping bag, he recalled the days when he had been surrounded by his family. He didn't particularly miss those days. His life now was so completely different that these memories merely popped up to illustrate that fact. Even when he was living with his family, Uchikawa had felt lonely. He never opened up to anyone, and thought that his ordinary life would never last. Deep down, he was convinced that one day it would all too easily fall apart. His busy days as a lawyer, his generous income, his nice house in Churinkan, his not bad-looking wife, his cute daughters, both attending private elementary school, his pedigreed dog. So when his life steadily fell apart bit by bit, and he was left all alone, he was actually relieved.
Thank God, he thought. Nothing to worry about now. I'm right back where I started. Is this what it means to go back to square one?
He curled up like a maggot in the sleeping bag and stared at the dark ceiling. He had sat in the same position for too long, and his joints ached. Shivering in the cold, making do with a cold bun for dinner, standing watch over the entrance of a cheap apartment that was ready to be torn down, watching the unattractive people coming in and out, peeing into a wash bucket.
Is this what it means to go back to square one?
He asked again. He remembered something he had forgotten to do. He crawled out of the sleeping bag, poured the urine in the bucket into the toilet, pushed the wobbly handle, and flushed it down. The sleeping bag had just started to warm up, and he had hesitated to get out.
Just leave it, he had thought.
But if he happened to slip in the dark, he would regret it. Afterward, he crawled back into the sleeping bag and shivered in the cold again.
Is this what it means? To go back to square one?
Most likely. He had nothing left to lose, other than his life. It was all very clear-cut. In the darkness, a razor-thin smile came to Ushikawa's lips.
Chapter 14. Aomame, This Little One of Mine. For the most part, Aomame's life had become filled with confusion. She felt as though she were blindly groping around in the dark. Ordinary logic and reason didn't function in this 1Q84 world, and she couldn't predict what was going to happen to her next. She felt sure, though, that she would survive the next few months and give birth to the baby. This was nothing more than a hunch, though a strong one. Everything was proceeding on the premise that she would give birth to this child. She could just sense it. She remembered the last words that Leader had spoken. You are fated to pass through great hardships and trials, he had said. Once you have done that, you should be able to see things as they are supposed to be. He knew something. Something vital. And he had tried, in vague and ambiguous terms, to give me this message, Aomame thought. The hardship he spoke of may have been when I took myself to the brink of death, when I took the pistol to that spot in front of the Esso sign, meaning to kill myself. But I came back, without dying, and discovered I was pregnant. This, too, might have been preordained. As they entered December, the winds grew fierce for a few days. The fallen Zelkova leaves whipped against the plastic screen on the balcony with a dry, biting sound. The cold wind let out a warning as it whistled between the bare branches of the trees. The caws of the crows grew sharper, keener. Winter had arrived. Every day, she became even more convinced that the baby growing in her womb was Tengo's child, until this theory became an established fact. It wasn't logical enough to convince a third party, but it made sense to her. It was obvious. If I'm pregnant without having had sex, who could the man possibly be other than Tengo? In November, she had begun putting on weight. She couldn't go outside, but she more than made up for it by continuing to work out and strictly watching her diet. After age 20, she never weighed more than 115 pounds. But one day, the scale showed she weighed 119, and after that, her weight never dropped below it. She felt like her face, too, had rounded out. No doubt, this little one wanted its mother to plump up. Together with this little one, she continued to keep watch over the playground at night, hoping to spot the silhouette of a large, young man sitting alone on the slide. As she gazed at the two moons, lined up side by side in the early winter sky, Amame rubbed her belly through the blanket. Occasionally, tears would well up for no reason. She would find a tear rolling down her cheek and falling to the blanket on her lap. Maybe it was because she was lonely, or because she was anxious, or maybe pregnancy had made her more sensitive. Or maybe it was merely the cold wind stimulating the tear ducts to produce tears. Whatever the reason, Amame let the tears flow without wiping them away. Once she cried for a while. At a certain point, the tears would stop, and she would continue her lonely vigil. No, she thought. I'm not that lonely. I have this little one with me. There are two of us. Two of us looking up at the two moons, waiting for Tengo to appear. From time to time, she would pick up her binoculars and focus on the deserted slide. Then she would pick up the automatic pistol to check its heft and what it felt like. Protecting myself, searching for Tengo, and providing this little one with nourishment. Those are my duties now. One time, as the cold wind blew and she kept watch over the playground, Amame realized she believed in God. It was a sudden discovery, like finding with the soles of your feet solid ground beneath the mud. It was a mysterious sensation, an unexpected awareness. Ever since she could remember, she had always hated this thing called God. More precisely, she rejected the people and the system that intervened between her and God. For years, she had equated those people and that system with God. Hating them meant hating God. Since the moment she was born, they had been near her, controlling her, ordering her around, all in the name of God, driving her into a corner. In the name of God, they stole her time and her freedom, putting shackles on her heart. They preached about God's kindness, but preached twice as much about his wrath and intolerance. At age 11, Amame made up her mind and was ultimately able to break free from that world. In doing so, though, much had been sacrificed. If God didn't exist, then how much brighter my life would be, how much richer, Amame often thought this. Then she should be able to share all the beautiful memories that normal children had, without the constant anger and fear that tormented her. And then, how much more positive, peaceful, and fulfilling her life might be. Despite all this, as she sat there, her palm resting on her belly, peeking through the slats of the plastic boards at the deserted playground, she couldn't help but come to the realization that she believed in God. When she had mechanically repeated the words of the prayer, when she brought her hands together, she had believed in a God outside the conscious realm. It was a feeling that had seeped into her marrow, something that could not be driven away by logic or emotion. Even hatred and anger couldn't erase it. But this isn't their God, she decided. It's my God. This is a God I have found through sacrificing my own life, through my flesh being cut, my skin ripped off, my blood sucked away, my nails torn, all my time and hopes and memories being stolen from me. This is not a God with a form. No white clothes, no long beard. This God has no doctrine, no scripture, no precepts, no reward, no punishment. This God doesn't give and doesn't take away. There is no heaven up in the sky, no hell down below. When it's hot and when it's cold, God is simply there. From time to time, she would recall Leader's final words before he died. She could never forget his rich baritone, just like she could never forget the feeling of stabbing a needle into the back of his neck. Where there is light, there must be shadow. Where there is shadow, there must be light. there is no shadow without light.